50 of them, for the rest of my life. After all the agony of anticipation, there wasn't much to it. Father Joe asked me no awkward questions about college, and I felt no obligation to tell him. Christ, after all, had said that father, mother, brother, and sister all had to be left behind to follow him. And that must apply to their hopes and ambitions for you, too. I might hurt someone sometime, but there was a greater purpose. Dom Aylred, however, wanted to know my S-level scores, and was pleased that they were good. Wouldn't they qualify me for entrance to Oxford or Cambridge? I was ready for his rather dangerous line of questioning. There was a Benedictine foundation at Oxford called St. Bennet's, specifically for monks who qualified to study there. Boys from Downside and Ampleforth, the Catholic public schools, who had vocations to their respective communities, went to St. Bennet's, but only after they'd taken their vows as monks. I made the argument that I should proceed in the same way. Dom Aylred appeared to accept this and had nothing further to say about the matter. Later, he relayed a suggestion through Father Joe that I should undertake a period of reflection before actually entering the novitiate. It would be open-ended, maybe weeks, maybe a month or two. In the meantime, I could study, attend divine offices, and work on the farm or on the estate, as I was already accustomed to doing, in preparation for becoming a member of the community. It was summer, and I loved working outside. I had an intense passion for the early history of the Benedictines, but never before had had the means or the time to pursue it. Now I had both. I might not have a cell or my black robes yet, but in all other respects I was as good as in. The doubts that had plagued me like a recurrent disease for so long abated as though they had lost not just the battle, but the war. The joy of my year of light so long ago, my Eden time, did not return, but I knew now that my calf love for this place had been insubstantial, a glorious mist rising over a meadow that evaporates by noon. Now another kind of joy suffused me. Not just the peace of core, but satisfaction that the journey had begun. Graham Greene says, in the end of the affair, that happiness is a kind of oblivion in which we lose our identity, and that was certainly how it seemed. Not much changed in my status, but I didn't care. Here things happened on an entirely different timescale than in the outside world. Like no other time I'd spent at core, there was no end. Before this, my visits were measured in days, or, if I was lucky, weeks. Now I could begin counting in years. Or rather, there was no need to count at all. Monks thought not in years, but in lifetimes, in centuries, not generations, in cycles, not in eras. The Benedictine time-space continuum prevailed, sub specie aeternitatis. Alpha in Omega, in our beginning is our end. The first offices of the day, lords and vigils, often said as the dawn light struck across the nave, never failed to bring this home. Every dawn, from every rumpled bed, an entity immeasurably stronger than the sum of its parts, reassembled to work yet again at the everyday task of brotherhood. 60-odd men, the workforce of prayer, commuted from their dwellings to their place of business and went about their matutinal tasks, skilled, experienced, getting on with the job, unwrapping that formidable engine, the chant, starting it up, turning on the power, recharging the core with quiet purpose. Whatever dream terrors and night dwellers I had just escaped, my solitude was no longer mine. Like each of them, I was alone, but not alone in being alone. The certainty I still regretted losing had not been true certainty. True certainty was in the routine, the habit, the rule, the chant, the the obedience to present superiors and past custom, the meaning of the words and thoughts and prayers, the countless thousands of mornings on which this same ritual had been repeated, and would be repeated long after all these men, including, soon, me, had been munched and churned and turned by the worms back into the loam that fed ourselves in the first place. The gentle force which flowed into me from Father Joe was not his alone. It came from these men. It flowed through them into him, and thence into me, as ordinary as water and as divine. The supremely peaceful, supremely loving Father Joe was as alone as me, but just like me, not alone in being alone. His true strength was that he was just another monk, an ordinary member of an extraordinary tradition. The gentle strength which bound him to them, and each him among them to the next, would one day bind me too. I could put my trust in this river of black, quietly winding through the darkness. Whatever happened, it would flow on through my life, as it had through so many others, a river of incalculable depth, in which you could sink but never drown, springing, as it always had, from the same million tiny freshets, flowing into the same trackless ocean. I was alone, but not alone in being alone. Chapter 11. Well, that couldn't last. I should have known. But happiness is not just oblivious. Happiness is also an idiot. It was a bright, windy morning. I was getting ready to go to the woods to do something with Frère Louis, my favorite work. Then Father Joe tapped on my door. I knew the minute the long face came round the door that the game was up. I had rarely seen that face not smiling. He sat down without a word. Never done that, either. He put the tips of his fingers together, making an open-plan church steeple. Was this Father Joe, or Mr. Joe, Vice President of Personnel?
Tony, dear, is there something you're not telling us?
My mind raced ahead, looking for damage control, openings, possible deals, anything. But I could see little wiggle room up there. I said nothing. Father Joe looked sad, disappointed, I suppose, that I wouldn't come clean.
Your father telephoned last night. He was wondering when you're going home, so you can get ready to go up to Cambridge.
This is home. I don't want to go to Cambridge.
Ah, but you must, dear.
Christ said we must leave father and mother behind to follow him.
He also spent many years acquiring wisdom and learning.
Please don't send me away. Please, dear Father Joe.
You have a scholarship.
It was a mistake. I didn't mean to win it. I don't want it. Someone else can have it.
That is not yours to decide, dear. It is a gift of God.
There was nothing to be said after that. No appeal, no plea bargain, no leniency. His quiet severity was unshakable. It was the gentleness with which the sentence was passed that really got to me. The massive door to my future closed with barely a click.
I'm sorry, Tony, dear. You must leave today.
Like Peter, poor, weak, deceitful Peter, I went out into the garden and wept bitterly. My room at St. John's was very like the one I'd stayed in at Queen's, except First Court was much larger and less monastic, and the room was pokier and shabbier. It was 16th century, built after the dissolution of the monasteries, and technically Protestant, but old and beamed and warped enough to provide the right setting for the course I'd chosen. I was going to let Cambridge into my life, and into this, my cell, as little as possible. I was here to acquire learning and wisdom, and nothing else. Other than study, I would continue to lead the contemplative life to the utmost of my ability, saying the offices every day, attending Mass every morning, eschewing the fleshpots and temptations of the great university, except maybe for the odd pint of an evening, which I would drink at the ancient bar next to the college kitchens called the Buttery. I would eat my meals in hall, which luckily resembled a giant refectory. In short, I would make St. John's my monastery. My banishment aside, Father Joe had exacted no retribution, offered no rebuke. Nor, in the long run, would my deceit be punished. He'd written me the next day, laying out cause conditions. I must complete the 3 years of an English degree. If I still wanted to enter the monastery after that, there would be no further obstacle. Cor and he would welcome me back with open arms. When I thought about it in the weeks before Cambridge, it began to look less daunting, less final and catastrophic than at first. I'd already waited for well over 3 years. What was another three? Actually, just over 2.5. I would be sitting at the feet of the finest scholars in the land. C.S. Lewis, F.R. Leavis, A.J. P. Taylor, E.M. Forster, C.P. Snow. I would be bettering my mind to the eventual benefit of Cor, and these were my favorite areas of study. A degree of happiness was possible. Happiness made time pass quickly. In the event, my first year did pass much as planned. Unlike Oxford, Cambridge had no monastic presence, but there was the Catholic chaplaincy, Fisher House. Fisher House was run, and partly financed, by the longtime Catholic chaplain of Cambridge University, Monsignor Alfred Gilby. Gilby was a one-man social phenomenon. In welfare state Britain, at an increasingly middle-class, progressive, meritocratic university, at the outset of the 60s, only a couple of years before Vatican II, he cut a fantastic and improbable figure. In appearance, he was every red-blooded English Protestant's worst nightmare, the archetypal papist priest. He came from a hugely wealthy family with one foot in Spain. They had made their money in fortified wine and spirits, and his mother was Spanish. It showed in his profile, which was irredeemably Iberian, with a powerful El Greco nose, huge sunken dark-rimmed eyes, and a mouth that early 19th-century romantic novelists would have called sensual and cruel. He was not sensual and cruel in the least, but he certainly lived in the early 19th century. Tall, thin, and supremely elegant, he insisted on wearing antique clerical garb, which he had custom tailored. Typical morning wear might be an ankle-length soutane, a shoulder cape with episcopal purple silk lining, a flat round black hat, and black patent leather shoes with solid silver buckles. He gave me a cast-off pair of these once, which I treasured, if for nothing else than that the buckles alone were worth hundreds of dollars. Nominally my size, they were so narrow that I could not force my clod-hopping Celtic hooves into them. I felt like an ugly sister trying on Cinderella's slipper. The tout ensemble was outrageously anachronistic, something the revolutions of 1848 ought to have swept forever from the face of Europe. Sinister, ultramontane, conspiratorial, beyond reactionary. He summed up everything the British mean by the word Jesuitical, though he rather disliked the Jesuits, and they returned the favor. No one would have been surprised to find a Torquemada in his family tree. When he bustled about the Cambridge streets, dark robes flapping over Regency shoes, he always gave the impression of being on some mysterious, far-reaching mission, possibly at the behest of Metternich or the Duke of Alba, involving double agents and Vatican gold. It was never clear how seriously he took all this, but he played it to the hilt. He was also blindingly charming and witty, a born diplomat who knew everyone in Oxford, Cambridge, the English Church, and the Catholic demimonde, and had a far-flung network of highly placed friends and relatives from Paris to Istanbul. When I began showing up at Mass every morning, he took me under his wing, and we became good friends. He did his best to adjust my vocation and steer me toward the public school communities at Downside or Ampleforth. If I had to be a Benedictine, he would murmur suavely, "Better to be active than contemplative, no?" Translation: Downside and Ampleforth, with their blue-chip social connections, were much more his cup of tea than a bunch of Frenchmen in the Isle of Wight moaning chant behind high walls. But he didn't push it, being far less of an intriguer than people believed. Except in his own interest, that is, where he was ruthless. Church progressives were naturally scandalized by everything about him, and were always trying to dislodge him from the highly visible and influential chaplaincy, but he beat them back time after time. I agreed with them in theory, but in practice he was irresistible, a once-in-a-lifetime character. He was also kind, generous, shrewd, and, provided you were willing to accept where he was coming from, which was, roughly speaking, pre-Enlightenment, very funny. Through Fisher House I met a lifelong Catholic friend, Piers Paul Reid, future novelist and son of the eminent literary critic Herbert Reid. Piers had gone to Ampleforth, and was as worldly as I was cloistered. He had a wicked intelligence beneath a deceptive boyish charm, which let him get away with all kinds of conversational outrage. He too was tall, elegant, and effortlessly witty. In a different age he might have been a Monsignor in training. He was a magnet for women, but had no amorous involvement I could detect. Instead, he always seemed to be involved in the love lives of at least two or three women friends, which he manipulated and documented with vast glee. I'd never met anyone this entertaining, but at the outset he both shocked me and made me rather nervous. I wasn't quite sure how we'd become friends. Maybe my monkishness titillated him, red meat for his mischief. He would bait me by taking unorthodox or ultra-progressive doctrinal positions, and would treat my orthodox responses with amused incredulity. "But surely we Catholics no longer accept the idea of papal infallibility." I suspected he didn't really hold such opinions, but I wasn't sure what his exact positions were. At best he was toying with the new theology, at worst he saw belief as a parlor game, but I could never be certain. He was so maddeningly nimble, so brilliantly ambiguous. If I challenged him, "You're playing a game. You're saying that to bait me," he would smoothly switch manner and become the offended true believer. "Are you questioning my faith, Tony? How dare you?" And smile his boyish smile. It was hopeless, but huge fun. I would say Compline way past midnight. No meat was redder than my vow of celibacy. Our most frequent area of scholastic disputation, the easiest bait of all. Which led seamlessly to his proposing to introduce me to one of his girlfriends. He held out the possibility like a dapper snake with an apple in its mouth. But there was no way. Not this Benedictine. Of course, if I had tried to bite the apple, Piers would have whisked it up his sleeve. The point was to tempt me, or even, perhaps, to watch me fall. Or was it? "How can you say that? Why would I manipulate a friend? This is a completely altruistic attempt to help you, to broaden you. What sin is there in going out with a girl? Unless you're a Manichaean. Are you a Manichaean, Tony?" And once again, I'd be saying Compline as the bells at Cor were ringing for Lords and Matins. Time shot by. It was extraordinarily easy to bury myself in academic pursuits. The line between the scholarly and the monastic has always been blurred, and the daily rhythm of reading, writing, and researching fit comfortably into the adapted template of Cor I lived in private. First-year exams were rolling around. After them was the prospect of summer vacation. Father Joe discouraged me from spending it at the monastery. I had good things to report about my first year: no loss of vocation, voluminous study. He felt I should make the most of my time in the world and take a summer course somewhere. A friend told me about a British Council program that provided assistance for summer courses. I applied, was approved, and was now set for my first trip to Umbria and Perugia's Università per Stranieri, where there was a month-long course in Italian art and literature, including La Divina Commedia. On the way, I would stop at Oberammergau in Bavaria, where a world-famous passion play was performed at the beginning of every decade. It was now 1960. After Perugia, I would head for Spain, another first-time trip, and amble around Benedictine and Cistercian houses there. I hitchhiked to Oberammergau and saw the passion play along with 20,000 other Catholics. It was deadly, like being at a very quiet sports event. I then hitchhiked to Austria, where I met up with the Catholic friend of an American author I'd met at Fisher House. He was a well-known English film director. His house was very luxurious and full of young film actors. I stayed a day or two. This gent then gave me the name of a Catholic friend of his, a prominent British petroleum executive in Milan. I duly hitchhiked to Milan and stayed a couple of days in his magnificent Baroque palazzo with some other young men. He was extremely gracious and told me to look up yet a third Catholic Brit in this circle, a well-known designer, if I got to Rome. But I never took up the third invitation, as it was time to head for Perugia. Not until much later did I realize that all my hosts were gay, and I'd probably been expected to provide certain services in return for their spectacular hospitality. Being a monk, I'd been too naive to know this. Being British, they'd been too polite to ask. As soon as I set foot out of the Fiat 600 that had given me the ride from Florence, I was in love with Umbria. So those little hills with their scattered olive groves and cypresses in the backgrounds of Giotto and Della Francesca weren't idealized images of some loftier Italy inhabited only by saints and Medicis. They were actual landscapes, rendered half a millennium ago, and still exactly the same. Another blow struck for the great principle of changelessness. I stayed in the flat of a sweet-faced widow called Signora Carra, whose husband had died, pointlessly, she said, at the very end of the war. Her fat, pampered, and arrogant son still lived with her, though he was 35, and had a perfectly good job in city government. For rent, he treated her like dirt. I had gotten the idea somehow that Carra meant hedgehog. At dinner the first night, I tried to break the ice by explaining that this had once been my nickname. Apparently, I insulted the family honor. The son flew into a rage, spat on my feet, and stormed out. So Signora Carra and I became friends. She had no English at all, but taught me more Italian in a month than I've learned since. My bedroom faced the gentle hills outside the city, and in the evening she would come shyly in, "Scusi, Tonino," to catch the tramonto, which sounded to me like between the mountains. I thought it the most beautiful and poetic word for sunset I'd ever heard. The course was a joke. There were students of every nation from New Zealand to Palestine, but unlike me they all knew, A, that the Università per Stranieri was a party school, and B, how to party. The professor giving the main course taught in Italian with a thick regional accent, Sicilian, I think, which was impossible to understand. He was huge and gaunt, with wild frizzy hair, and looked exactly like the mad uncle in Fellini's Amarcord, who sits in a tree whenever possible, bellowing, "Voglio una donna!" The lecture hall was full for the first few days, and empty for the rest of the month. August in Spain was an unpleasant surprise. I had expected to find lodging at various religious houses, but the clergy and monks were hostile and suspicious when they answered their doors, slamming them in my face when I gave my pitch. They certainly didn't recognize Christ in me. The rule of Benedictine hospitality seemed to have been suspended, presumably by the caudillo. This put a strain on my budget. Ditches and beaches had to substitute for guest houses. In turn, this meant evading the Guardia Civil, a bunch of thugs as trigger-happy as the religious were unchristian. But Franco's buddies couldn't spoil Andalusia, which gave Umbria a fierce run for its money. Back in Cambridge, I found I'd got a first-class honours, on my first-year exams. It was actually better than a first, not all the way to a double first, but good enough to win a university-wide prize called the Whitman. I saw it as a sign. Time to return to the monastic regimen, after my wanderings through Europe's garden of worldly delights. I planned great stuff for my second year. The Provençals, modern theatre. Perhaps it was the latter that prompted me one evening, pretty much on a whim, to go see a theatrical review called Beyond the Fringe. In my general ignorance of Cambridge social life, I was not aware that there was already quite a buzz about this production. Nor was I aware that there was a Cambridge institution called Footlights, which put on a comic review every year, nor that there was a festival in Edinburgh every summer, nor that it had a Fringe, unofficial semi-underground shows that were not in the festival proper, including the Cambridge Footlights Review and its Oxford counterpart, nor that Edinburgh was where Beyond the Fringe had got its start. So I had no idea what to expect when I entered the Arts Theatre in Cambridge that night. On stage were two men from Cambridge, both tall and gangly, Peter Cook and Jonathan Miller, and two men from Oxford, neither tall nor gangly, Alan Bennett and Dudley Moore. What I saw were 2 hours or so of sketches, a generic term covering many different forms. Dramatic sketches with two or more characters and a beginning and end, monologues, parodies, musical pastiche, and a couple of long montages, or sequences of various kinds of material involving the whole cast. One was a nonsensical play in miniature, which subsumed all of Shakespeare's histories, awash in the incomprehensible references of which the greatest writer in the English language is capable. There was an achingly stiff upper lip vignette of the Battle of Britain from an RAF pilot, savaging the hallowed myths of British decency, sang-froid, and wartime bonhomie. There was a speech by Peter Cook as Tory Prime Minister Harold Macmillan, nailing the foggy-minded leader of our foggy nation. Dudley Moore used his grand piano as a scintillating weapon to eviscerate Beethoven and Schubert and Benjamin Britten. A town meeting on civil defence dramatised better than 100 campaign for nuclear disarmament pamphlets the fatuous illogic of nuclear deterrence. A condemned man on his way to the gallows was comforted by a hearty take-your-medicine prison governor. Perhaps best of all was a gloriously vacuous Church of England sermon from Alan Bennett.
"Life is rather like opening a tin of sardines. We are all of us looking for the key. Others think they've found the key, don't they? They roll back the lid of the sardine tin of life. They reveal the sardines, the riches of life therein, and they get them out. They enjoy them. But, you know, there's always a little bit in the corner you can't get out. I wonder, is there a little bit in the corner of your life? I know there is in mine."
What I did was laugh, and laugh, and laugh, and laugh. And as I laughed, I sensed something coming together and something else falling away. What was coming together here in one place, on one stage, were many, many strands of cultural and intellectual thought, some connected, some not, that had been growing and creeping across the landscape for years. Tendrils of scepticism and irreverence, all having something to do with the post-war realization of just how murderous and ludicrous in 1960 was the idea of nation and nationalism. All the sanctimonious and meretricious claptrap that sustained in every one of us the false self of national identity, the clown makeup of Britishness. The four cast members of Beyond the Fringe, which was about to become a phenomenal success in the West End and on Broadway, consistently downplayed critical glorification of their masterpiece insisting it wasn't satire, and even if it was, of minor social significance. But for those who heard and saw what they had to say, the social significance was impossible to avoid. No one had ever gathered in one place the sacred goods of the Sceptred Isle. Parliament, the Church of England, V-Day, the BBC, Shakespeare, the royal family, the courts, had asked just what it was all worth, considering the damage that had been done in its name over the last couple of centuries. And no one had done it so gloriously, so dazzlingly, so unforgettably. What was falling away was my vocation. I didn't realize it at the time, because nothing negative was taking place. There was no cataclysmic conversion, no thunderclap on the road to anywhere. On the contrary, the experience seemed all of a part with my habitual ways of feeling and perceiving. Not unlike the very similar sense of wonder and community I felt in the dawn light at Core. Except that this was its reverse side. It wasn't even that different from a religious service. We were sitting in the same formation as in church, though the pews were a bit more comfortable, attending a kind of ritual in which four black-clad young priests, albeit in the vernacular and without a shred of reverence, dealt briskly with sacred matters. There were a few huffy exits, seat backs banged in protest, walking sticks and handbags swinging their outrage up the aisles. For the most part, there was elation, release, celebration. The theatre was full of crazed joy, helpless, transfigured faces, laughing at things they'd probably never laughed at before, or had never been allowed to laugh at before. Perhaps things which had never been laughed at least not for 100 years or more. I loved it. Not just what was being said, but these waves of demented delight, this wild energy surging through 500 people, connecting us all for a timeless instant when truth flashed, then flashed again, and connected us again. The laughter was magical, mysterious, pure, an irresistible force. Where did it come from? How did you conjure it up? How did you do that? I wanted, then and there, to learn what Cook, Miller, Bennett, and Moore did so effortlessly. To have an audience bound together in this delicious way, united by this ethereal stuff. It didn't strike me as a temptation, as a worldly pleasure dangled in front of me. In fact, the laughter presented itself as something akin to holy, something with awesome transformative power. I went into that theatre a monk. I came out a satirist. Save the world through prayer? I don't think so. I'm going to save it through laughter. Part 2. Chapter 12. Outside the vast picture window, the evening mist was gunmetal grey, sluggish as the heaving, oily ocean. The setting sun glowed through it, tinting the conflicted waves the glistening orange-red that beef goes when it's beginning to turn. My first wild, whirling day in L.A., years earlier, I'd been stunned by how depressing the Pacific sunset was. I'd driven west down Pico to see it, and as I hit Santa Monica, I just came crashing down. The girl I was with said I must be bad tripping, because the Californian sunset was the most fantastically groovy thing in the whole world. But it wasn't drugs. I didn't do drugs in the 60s. Too scared of them. No, I was clean and sober, and there it was, a mighty flame-gold, episcopal purple, hot pink light show, spread out across the ocean, and all I could think was, this is the end. This is as far as you can go. After this, it all starts over again. Every L.A. evening from then on, it was the same. However up I'd been all day, however well the meetings had gone, however officially magnificent, the mountainless tramonto. I would just come crashing down, down into the depths. De profundi cele, clamavo ad te, Domine. The house was pretty sumptuous. Belonged to Robbie Robertson or Levon Helm or someone. Someone from the band. But there was nothing to do. Nowhere to go. No one to call. I didn't want to turn on the TV because Reagan would be on it. And I didn't want to start ranting to myself about Reagan. Reagan, the putrid meat Pacific sunset. The end, as far as you could go. Beyond whom, there was nothing. There you go again. Same useless drivel you've ranted to yourself 100,000 times. In the 2 years since he ascended to the throne, loved and admired by all for his fantastic acting talents and brilliant election strategy. It was the emptiness of the Malibu night. There was nothing to do but obsess. No doubt, at this very moment, just a few miles up the Pacific Coast Highway, Joan Didion was obsessing about something, too. But it was impossible to get Reagan's face off my internal screen. Those simpering, wattled features. "Face looks like a scrotum," Richie Pryor once said. The face would even chuckle its way into my dreams, enter their narrative, however hard I resisted with all the exotic resources dreams give you. There it would be, rising from the plane wreck, appearing out of the snake-strewn dreamscape, always with the same murmured message. "Come on, I'm not as bad as all that, am I?" Which was the whole problem with Reagan. He was as bad as all that, and worse. But the face made it just fine. I was in L.A. to kill two birds with one stone. One, promote my latest publication, a parody civil defense manual called Meet Mr. Bomb. And two, start shooting another very different parody, a low-budget comedy. Meet Mr. Bomb was a cheery pamphlet purportedly put out by the Futile Preparedness Agency, detailing all the futile things you could do to not survive before, during, and after the winnable war our plucky, battle-hardened commander-in-chief was proposing. It had been written by humorists like Bruce McCall and Kurt Anderson. As its editor, I was pretty proud of it. I'd privately dedicated it to the cast of Beyond the Fringe, in honor of their seminal civil defense piece. It had a shot. Other parodies I'd edited with much the same team of writers, like Not the New York Times and Off the Wall Street Journal, had between them sold almost 1 million copies. Newsweek had enthused over their advance copy of Meet Mr. Bomb. They were thinking about putting me and a couple of colleagues on their cover. My publisher felt we were being cautious in printing 200,000. Our newsstand distributors in L.A. were the biggest newsstand guys in Southern California, and Southern California had been a good market for parody. Naturally, in my outdated 70s naivete, I assumed that anyone who made their bottom line from newsstands would have to be live-and-let-livers, realists, subscribers to the principle that you can make a buck from anyone's point of view. You'd have to be to display The Nation and Hustler and Commentary side by side, wouldn't you? Wrong. Our distribution company, or rather its boss, was not remotely interested in live-and-let-live, or realism, or probably even a free press. He was a Razorback Reaganite, and had quite disliked Meet Mr. Bomb, describing it in his most restrained assessment as treason. According to my publisher, who'd called minutes earlier, Ronnie's boy had shredded the 100,000 copies we'd shipped to him, and refused to shell out a cent of the $100,000 he normally would have had to pay for the privilege. The project was effectively bankrupted. The local radio and TV interviews I'd planned for later in the week had been cancelled. Through the smog, the sun was low and red and tiny. Like a naked emergency bulb, outside a hospital you'd tell the ambulance to drive by. Hit me with the morphine and try the one in Long Beach. This was the end. As far as I could go. Beyond this, There was nothing. The question was, after this, would it all start over again? Far worse than the fact of Mr. Baum's demise was its meaning. We were in a new, barren, Babbitt-ridden landscape. Our little publishing venture might not be able to function in it. I was interested in, perhaps qualified to do, only one kind of project. Stage, page, or screen, I didn't much care how it got to the public, it had to be about something that mattered. A funny statement on a vital issue. A small but painful bullet in the posterior of an odious power structure. Most important, something that might make the powerless laugh at what they weren't supposed to. Lenny Bruce told me that backstage once. The best laughs come from things you're not supposed to laugh at. I'd butchered a few holy cows over the last decade or so. Woodstock and the movement, when they were still pretty sacred ruminants. American historical icons, the Kennedy murders. Vietnam, cancer, political meat on the hoof by the cartload. Other people's religion, not as much as I would have liked. And my own religion, a lot. Not the Benedictines, though. Not yet. In the pasture of my soul there remained one lonely cow I'd never laid a finger on. Her name was Jo. My abattoir had been the National Lampoon, where I'd arrived in the summer of 1971, though I'd been writing for the magazine since its first issues in early 1970. The magazine was very short-handed at the time, so I went to work at a variety of editorial chores. That fall, on one of those washed-clean, windswept, dazzlingly sharp mornings peculiar to Manhattan, when the light makes everything glitter with the promise of something utterly new in the course of human events, co-founder Henry Beard invited me to become the Lampoon's first managing editor. It was glorious. For the only time in 6 years of wandering across America as a stand-up comedian, or rather a sit-down comedian, my partner and I use stools, in a haze of unaccustomed consumer gratification, half-understood mythology, insincere nostalgia for my British homeland, and bitter disappointment. This wasn't Camelot, or the New Frontier, or the Great Society. A strong, uncomplicated feeling blazed forth. This is the place. I spent the next 7 years of my life dreaming up the most scabrous things I could about its leaders, and history, and customs and beliefs. But it was at this moment that I fell unconditionally in love with America. I hadn't come close to doing what I'd set out to do that night in Cambridge more than a decade ago, the night I heard the holy laughter. It had been far easier to make a very comfortable living sucking chuckles from those whom Abby Hoffman was calling Pig Nation. To settle into the soft trap of conformity. At work, write one thing for those who control the means of TV production. At home, write the other, more honest, possibly world-changing thing, and keep it in a drawer. Keeping it in a drawer had to stop. I owed that much to Father Joe. I'd abandoned one vocation for another, and then, in effect, abandoned that one too. Father Joe, far away across the Atlantic, was not so constantly in my thoughts as before, but he had shaped my sense of vocation and the obligations that went with it. The Lampoon was giving me the chance to make up for my decade of torpor by dedicating myself to a new community, this one inspired by the unholy spirit, to take a new set of vows of disobedience, stability of satirical purpose, conversion of the easy life, and, given the Lampoon's felonious salaries, of poverty. Nothing I'd done comedically so far was currency here. Fine by me. There was a heady lack of respect for the movement, with its glib maxim, if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem, which had always seemed to me problematic. Habituated to the sanctimonious Solons of San Francisco and the lugubrious lefties of L.A., for whom the Hollywood Ten was still a hot-button issue, I found this disrespect hilarious and liberating. There was no line drawn, as there always had been in TV or teach-in, beyond which things were just not funny, Tony. The Lampoon's humor worked because it was about things that were off-limits to all sides. That old Lenny Bruce yardstick. Radical, yes. But the radicalism of the White House, and of the White Panthers, demanded radical humor. Extremism in defense of levity is no vice either. In these, its glory years, the magazine expressed and nurtured the internationalism that typified the 70s and so maddened the patriot right. Various other Brits were involved at various times, like Alan Corrin, editor of Punch. Several French comic artists were in the extended Lampoon family. A South African, Danny Abelson, became an editor. One of India's most prominent journalists wrote a parody of the Times of India, which doubtless reduced four or five readers to helpless laughter. Most significant, the magazine included several brilliant Canadians. Primus inter pares was Sean Kelly, a Jesuit-trained college professor, small and wiry, with a huge wiry brain, and a Celtic knack for things that rhymed, from rock lyrics to T.S. Eliot. Sean and I, severally or together, were responsible for a number of satires on Catholic themes. With another Canadian, Michel Choquette, Sean wrote The Best Known, a comic starring the Protestant superhero Son of God, a.k.a. Jesus the Messiah. His mission here below? To combat the Scarlet Woman of Rome and her lover, the diabolic Antichrist in the Vatican, whose slogan is, Power to the Papal. The Catholic, or ex-Catholic, aspect of the Lampoon was anomalous. Comedy and humor writing had long been dominated by Jewish giants like S.J. Perelman, Lenny Bruce, Mort Sahl, Woody Allen, Mel Brooks. The list is endless. Although the Lampoon had significant Jewish talent, Catholic humor was a breakthrough area. Reflecting the convulsions the church was going through, it got enormous response. One of the very first pieces I did for the Lampoon was a kiddie version of the Gospels, taking the feminist attack on the church to its logical extreme. A female messiah, or rather, messiah, Jessica Christ. At her Last Supper, Jessica took bread and broke it, and gave it to her apostles, saying, Take, eat, for this is my body. Hubba hubba, said the apostles. Blasphemy was a novel experience. On one level, it was oddly comforting. It had been years now since I practiced my religion, but it was still a deep vein of my identity. I felt at home creating mayhem in places where I'd once been so dutiful. It even bought me some group acceptance. I was still tentative about American political and cultural reference, but Catholicism was an area where no one could challenge me. Plus, it was international. The idiocies of growing up in the one true and universal church had been the same for all of us, in the US, the UK, or Canada. Except, it hadn't been the same for me. Unlike Sean Kelly, or for that matter, my friend George Carlin, I hadn't kicked against the pricks as a kid. I'd been a monk in all but habit. So what was going on? I suppose I took it on faith, as did many others, that doctrines of any kind, not just of the church, but of patriotism, capitalism, and socialism, of art, education, psychology, movie-making, golf, sex, embroidery, deserved to be torn down just for being doctrines, along with the guilt or intellectual inertia that kept us beholden to them. That was the 60s for you, or rather, the 70s, when for most people the 60s actually took place. But blasphemy and nihilism aren't quite the same. This rationale didn't really answer what drove me to blasphemy. Perhaps it was that blasphemy is practically an occupational requirement for your average apostate. Look at the Goliards. Look at Rabelais. Look at Luther. Luther actually wrote satires. Nothing explained the giddy, scary laughter that blasphemy induced in me, the sense of being cut free, floating in a seductive void, with no idea where I was going and no concern about it either, a kind of high, really, as if blasphemy was my drug of choice. There was often a kind of guilty hangover to the high, and when I came down, a shadowy misgiving, lingering fear of damnation. Were we quite sure hell was over? As Sean Kelly used to say, a lapsed Catholic is someone who no longer believes in hell, but knows he's still going there. For me, the issue was more personal. The real question was, what would Father Joe think of Jessica Christ? His reactions never failed to surprise me, but even he, I felt, might balk at Jessica. Was that my aim? To sever the bond with him at last? To break free of the gentle stranglehold he had on my soul? Or whatever souls become when you don't believe you have one anymore? Right after Beyond the Fringe, I couldn't go to CORE, or even write. I was too confused and excited about my coming plunge into the world and what its fallout might be. I didn't want my new mission to weaken my bond to Father Joe. On the contrary, I wanted his approval, but without his catching on that I foresaw the possibility of a new vocation. When I did finally write to him, I settled for a subtle blend of evasion and preemptive self-defense. The letter became longer and longer, more and more convoluted, veering between self-justifying apology and scholastic rationales of satire, all of them extremely unfunny. Father Joe wrote back soothingly. I made it into Footlights with several others, among them John Cleese and Graham Chapman. Graham and I launched a comedy team, the only time in my career as a comedian that I was the straight man. I fell in love, with a friend of Piers, of course. We heavy-petted a lot, went to Italy to maybe have sex in a tent. Didn't, broke up. At each stage I wrote to Father Joe, and he wrote back soothingly. Footlights took over my life completely. I was cast in the annual Footlights Review and met my future wife, Judy Christmas, who was a big cheese in the Cambridge theatre world and hung out with the likes of Trevor Nunn and Ian McKellen. I stopped going to confession, since confession was typically on Saturday night. And Saturday night was the best night to sneak into Girton College and Judy's narrow undergraduate bed, where we had serial sex until dawn. At least I wasn't committing the mortal sin of using birth control. Since it was hard to sneak out of Girton College on Sunday mornings, I soon stopped going to Mass as well. No problem. It gave me time for a couple dozen more orgasms. I graduated, my degree having plunged from quasi-double first to a 2-2, the last from bottom grade. At this point, my plan, since time immemorial, had been to return to CORE, where I would be welcomed with open arms by Father Joe and become a monk. I was so embarrassed, I couldn't set pen to paper. Father Joe set pen to paper frequently, and soothingly. A baby girl soon appeared, out of wedlock. There may have been rejoicing in the Vatican that another future Catholic had defeated the satanic forces of contraception, but there wasn't much cheering in the scuzzy end of Hampstead, where Judy and I were now shacking up. I had a new partner, Nick Ullett, another alumnus of Footlights, Graham Chapman having decided to become a doctor. We appeared at clubs like the Blue Angel and Peter Cook's establishment, now passed from his hands into those of a highly satirical Lebanese honcho named Raymond Nash, one of Christine Keeler's Legion boyfriends. At their insistence, Judy and their new granddaughter soon went to live with her parents, the Christmases. Understandably, they were not at the time evincing much good cheer at our tidings of great joy. I slunk away to CORE to try and get my bearings in this crazy new landscape. Father Joe was far less alarmed, far more serene about the situation than I, or Judy, or my non-in-laws. He urged me to think only of the baby and Judy. Be unselfish, be loving, be patient. Be with her whenever you can. The Christmases didn't agree, didn't ever want her to see me again, would ring jingle bells only if I jumped off Tower Bridge. So, like most wayward British swains down the centuries, I went to America. Father Joe's soothing letters over the next few months persuaded me that the right thing to do, despite the opposition, was to return to England, marry Judy, and bear my new family back to New York. It would have to be a civil ceremony, given the situation with the in-laws. Father Joe didn't care, and gave it his blessing. It meant Judy and I would now be living in permanent sin. But never in all this mess had he ever used the word sin, or wrong, or guilt, or even should have. He said he would put the three of us in his prayers. Soon he had to make it four. Reluctant fatherhood is no way to raise children. I had, as an excuse for my absences, our comedy team's relative success in the U.S. Our manager insisted we were going to be the Beatles of comedy, which kept us constantly on the road, and when in New York, out at clubs till the wee hours. Any remaining free time was needed to entertain the comedy demi-monde. Thanks to America's amber waves of gain, beer, whiskey, fries, pork, pancakes, biscuits, smoked fish, corn dogs, cheese balls, Johnny cakes, apple pan dowdy, deep-fried Heath bar sandwiches with caramel sauce, etc., etc., stretching in terrifying abundance across the fruited plain, I exploded from 170 to 250 pounds. Since my partner had the build of a stick insect, this made us officially funnier, backing into the archetype of Laurel and Hardy, Abbott and Costello, Gleason and Carney. More success meant more freedom from paternal duties. My massive fatness also guaranteed my reluctant fidelity. I have a shot of myself and Nick hosting the Advertising Awards of 1967, in which, though fatter, I look indistinguishable from my father, who in that year was 56. I had almost no contact with my parents during this time. Vaguely, from my sister's letters, I pieced together that Dad's career had collapsed entirely, in part because his traditional approach to stained glass was out of favor in the 60s, but mostly because there just wasn't much ecclesiastical work to be had. The attention of post-Vatican II Catholics was certainly not on church adornment. He'd had a couple of humiliating jobs, using the engineering skills he'd acquired in the RAF. Mum had gone to work quite happily at a local chemical factory, the source of the severe pollution in my beloved Rivoli. Her first purchase with her earnings had been a fridge. I can't remember exchanging more than a few words with Dad before I left for America, other than to tell him that he was a grandfather. I was so desperate and distracted at the time that I didn't really register his reaction. Only much later did I remember that it was utter delight. Our performance schedule left time for little more than occasional mad dashes to Europe. I got to Cor perhaps once or twice a year, and then only for a day. On one of these visits, not long after emigrating, I felt compelled to confess to Father Joe that I no longer practiced the faith. I'd been very uneasy about making this revelation, but he seemed to consider it no more worthy of note than a passing spell of bad weather. Whenever I came to Cor, despite my lapsarian status, some gem would always emerge from our chats, which, though it would be a Christian and Benedictine gem, and I no longer viewed those templates as having much relevance to my life, always had some immediate application to it. There were frequent letters, in one direction or the other. The rush I'd get from the Isle of Wight postmark and his spindly copperplate was always startling amid the constant melee in which I now lived, of planes, motels, and rental cars, of dates and running orders and rehearsals, of deals and meals and interviews, of New York openings and L.A. studios, the pressure for new material, and, worst pressure of all, the endless rows of placid white ovals out in the darkness of clubs and concert halls and gyms, waiting to be jump-started into laughter. That envelope from Cor held the promise of something exquisitely out of place in this world, a flash cut of a chestnut grove leading down to the sea. It held the prospect of an old-fashioned weekend, surrounded by familiar faces who would need no help to laugh. After I read his letter, I would always feel cleansed and renewed, as if my sweaty, pendulous new body had slimmed back down, its protective layers vaporized by his warmth. In 1968, soon after starting another menial job, Dad died suddenly. Collapsed down the stairs one cold fall morning, his dinged and dented Cornish heart rebelling at the prospect of more disappointment, signaling its surrender in his empurpled face. My little brother caught him as he fell. His last words, typically by now full of sad self-knowledge, resigned to failure and death. Perhaps I should have taken better care of myself. I rushed home from some standard-issue excitement in L.A. My mother seemed quite chirpy, and appeared to have dispersed as little as possible on the funeral arrangements. I was angry at myself for not having been there on the spot, in a position to have done better. Most of all, I was horrified at how little I felt about my father's death. After the funeral, I went down to Core. It had been a while, and Father Joe was delighted to see me. Even at this mournful moment, we fell without thinking into an easy dialogue, like two old jazz musicians picking up on each other's licks. Then it came home to me why I'd found it hard to weep for Dad. Despite our rapprochement and my pride in his artistic integrity, he'd never been as much my father as Father Joe. My two dads had been a defiant adolescent formulation, inaccurate despite the truth at its core. One man was far more my dad than the other, the one I thought of all the time, with alternating love and relief, with simultaneous guilt and anger and bafflement at the way bonds between men evolve. That was when I cried for Dad, because he must have known. He was a smart and sensitive guy. How lonely and desolate to discover that his firstborn, war-born son had found another father. Worse still, that he'd never had time to find a path to me, nor I to him. It was too late when I left home, and too soon when he died. The lampoon changed everything, slowly, subtly, but inexorably. A few months into my tenure as managing editor, I realized one night that I hadn't thought about Father Joe or Cor for weeks. Like many things I was experiencing at the magazine, it was a new and not unpleasant feeling. Until quite recently, hardly a day passed that I didn't brood upon the road not taken. How things would have been if, upon completion of my studies, I had turned my back on it all, whatever the cost, and returned to the banks of that river of black. A letter came from Cor, and I couldn't remember ever doing this before. I didn't open it right away. There was an aura of obligation about it now, like a letter from home when you're